This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think you did a little too much LDS.
LDS? Come on, why don't you let me give you a lift? I have a notorious weakness for hard luck cases, that's why I work with Whale.
We don't want to be in any trouble.
You've already been that. Come on.
Well, thank you very much.
Don't mention it. And don't try anything either. I got a tire iron right where I can get at it. So, you were at Berkeley?
I was not. Memory problems, too.
Oh. What about you? Where are you from?
Iowa.
Oh, landlubber. Come on, what the hell were you guys really trying to do back there? It wasn't some kind of macho thing, was it? Because if that's all, I'll be real disappointed. I really hate that macho stuff.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
What's going to happen when you release the whales?
They're going to have to take their chances.
What does that mean exactly, take their chances?
It means that they will be at risk from whale hunters the same as the rest of the humpbacks. What did you mean when you said all that stuff back at the Institute about extinction?
I meant
that... He meant what you said on the tour. That if things keep going the way they are, the humpbacks will disappear forever.
Oh, that's not what he said, farm boy. Admiral, if we were to assume those whales are ours to do with as we pleased, we would be as guilty as those who caused, past tense, their extinction. I have a photographic memory. I see words.
Are you sure it isn't time for a colorful metaphor?
You're not one of those guys from the military, are you, trying to teach whales to retrieve torpedoes or some dipshit stuff like that?
No, ma'am, no dipshit.
Well, good. That's one thing I would have let you off right here.
Gracie is pregnant.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Traffic FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original series. I'm Ken Tripp, hosting this week as the Commodore is on some needed shore leave. We have yet another fantastic show for all our red shirts and blue beamers out there in Trek.fm land. So welcome, everyone. And we have with us, as always, the co-host and the co-star, the Trek expert aboard and ready for warp speed. Hello, Jeff Harlan. How are you, sir?
I am doing great. Had a pretty good weekend. Spent some time with Mrs. Atos over on the Queen Mary out in Long Beach. We were chaperoning the prom for the high school that I work at.
Oh, that must have been a blast. Now, just out of curiosity, do the kids go home at night, or do they stay on the ship as well?
They went home. The kids that I work with, the prom ended at 11, and we saw them all off, waited for their parents to pick them up, and then we went back inside of the ship for the adult prom.
Excellent. Sounds like fun.
That lasted until about 1 a.m.
Aren't you getting kind of old for that stuff there, Atos?
Nah.
That's good. Well, I'm glad you and Megan had a nice weekend. That sounds real special, and it's something that I've always wanted to go aboard the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
and just experience. It looks like an absolutely beautiful ship.
Yeah, it is. We got a room on board, and we spent the night and took we got some tours and got to see the ship this morning.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, she's no Enterprise, but she looks pretty sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so what are we doing? Well, we're walking through all the Kirk and crew movies through Star Trek Into Darkness. That's our goal. And already we've covered TMP and The Wrath of Khan during a hit show where we pitched them against each other. And last week, our crew here covered the search for Spock, and this week we get on to the voyage home. So, Jeff, I know that you're a pretty big fan of all things movie-wise, just like I am. And what I'm going to run through real quickly is the synopsis of the film. But before we get into that too far, when you hear Star Trek IV, is this one of the movies that you come back and watch fairly often, or is this one of them that it's a good movie, but I never think to watch it?
It's a good movie, and it's a really good one to watch with someone who's not like a really big Star Trek fan, but it's not one that I go for just by myself. I'm not sure exactly why, but it's unless I'm watching like 2, 3, 4 in sequence, I don't really tend to watch it just by itself.
Yeah, you know, I'm similar to that, and I think there's a common theme among Star Trek fans. So this will be interesting thing to touch on as we go. So let me just give a brief synopsis of the movie, and then we'll get into your initial thoughts of it. So the movie starts off pretty much with the crew stranded on Vulcan, refitting their Klingon bird of prey to go back home, back to Earth, to stand trial for stealing the Enterprise, amongst other things. But as this is happening, a giant probe, a humongous pipe-looking probe, is heading towards Earth, and it's disabling starships on its way. It gets into Earth orbit. The power is knocked out across the planet, across the giant space station, and it starts wreaking havoc with the weather systems. Back on Vulcan, Kirk and the crew get ready to depart. Spock has some conversations with his mother. Kirk gets some more amplifying information on how his son was killed by the Klingons, and they leave heading back to Earth, ready for trial. Meanwhile, back on Earth, as things are getting worse and worse, they realize that the weather patterns are starting to block out the sun, and that the Earth's existence is now in jeopardy. So they send out a radio message to all ships to avoid the planet Earth at all costs. And of course, this is picked up by the bird of prey with Kirk and crew heading home. And they do some analysis on the signals that are coming from the probe, that this very disruptive signal, and they determine that the probe is targeting Earth's oceans. As they play with the signal and manipulate the signal, they realize that it is trying to reach out to and speak with and communicate with humpback whales. Obviously, in the 23rd century, humpback whales are no longer around. So the team aboard the bird of prey radios back to Earth saying, we are going to go back in time, and we are going to bring back some humpback whales from the 20th century and hopefully get this thing to communicate with it. The ship does a slingshot around the sun, and they wind up in Earth in the mid-1980s, which is very topical, maybe since this movie was made in 1986, and they wind up in San Francisco. While in San Francisco, they meet up with a cetacean scientist named Dr. Gillian Taylor, who works at the Cetacean Institute in Sausalito, California, who just happens to have two humpback whales in captivity. They work with the rest of the team to build a tank in the bird of prey that they can fill with water and beam the whales into. One of the problems they had, though, when they landed on Earth is that they, after the slingshot around the sun, they ran out of power. And they need to refuse the dilithium crystals, so they have a team that goes to the USS Enterprise, the aircraft carrier, that is Chekhov in Uhura, to take its high-energy photons and revitalize the dilithium dilithium crystals. During that attempt, Chekhov gets injured, chased by Marines, and he's in the hospital. Kirk and crew beam into the hospital to rescue Chekhov. While this is happening, Mr. Scott is working on securing some transparent aluminum. Mr. Sulu is transporting the plexiglass that's needed for the tanks via a Huey helicopter, and the whole crew assembles back on the bird of prey along with Dr. Taylor, who, as Kirk is being beamed aboard, hugs him, and then they go zooming off beam aboard the whales, which were since released and being chased by whale hunters. They They get in front of the harpoon. The ship lands right in front of the harpoon before it could strike the whales. They beam the whales back to the ship. They manage to slingshot back around the sun. They crash land into San Francisco Harbor. The whales are released from their tanks, or Captain Kirk gallantly releases them from the tanks. They then begin to communicate with the probe. What is said to the probe and what is said to the whales is kept from the audience. And eventually, after some, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 minutes of communications, the probe seems satisfied. It stops wreaking havoc with the Earth, starts to sail on. The clouds open up. The sun comes out. The crew celebrates. And then at that point, they are brought back to Starfleet headquarters, where they must stand trial. Spock, Kirk, the whole team are in their dress uniform, standing before the president of the United Federation of Planets, where they are told in no uncertain terms that all the charges have been dropped against the crew and all the focus is on Admiral Kirk, who is being demoted back to captain to be given his own ship again. And the crew and the captain disembark. They take a shuttle up to the space dock. They go circling over the Excelsior. It looks like they're going to get the Excelsior. And there's a brand new Enterprise, NCC-1701-A, awaits them. They board, they take her out of space dock, and warp into their next adventure. How was that, Jeff? Did I capture most of it?
Yeah, that sounded good.
All right, so there we are. So, Jeff, do you remember when you first saw this movie and your initial thoughts of it?
I think I missed it when it was in the theaters, just because we didn't have a whole lot of money to go out to the movies at that time. I do remember seeing it when it came out on video. And
now, were you in Germany?
I was in Germany at that point when it came out in video. I was living, I think, in Texas when it came out in the theaters.
Okay. And again, you know, just kind of give me what were your feelings with this movie? It's a very, very different vibe with this one.
Yeah, this one was a lot different than all the other Star Trek movies, I mean, before and after. And it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more comedic. You know, it's one that, you know, you can pop in and just have a good laugh with the characters. You know, it's more in line with some of the episodes like Piece of the Action or Trouble with Tribbles, where you got a lot of comedy going on.
Yeah, and you had mentioned before that, I asked that question earlier for a very specific reason. If it was something that you like to go and watch and put in from time to time, and you mentioned that you like to watch it with other people. So we know that this movie had the best domestic haul of any of the original series movies. It reached across a greater audience. It is known as the one with the whales. But I, like you, am similar. I don't necessarily go and watch it. If there's other people that are interested in a movie or just wanting to watch a movie and I'm feeling like a Star Trek movie, that is the perfect one to put in because everybody just enjoys it. It has mass appeal, which is something that Star Trek kind of struggled with. So I'm on the same page as you. And as you were saying earlier, I guess you kind of feel similarly that this is something that you'd put on with other people that weren't necessarily Star Trek fans or that you're trying to bring into Star Trek, perhaps?
Yeah, it's just something that even if they don't like Star Trek, they can appreciate the fact that it's set in the present day. And it's, mm-hmm. They can get some amusement of the fish out of water of these characters trying to interact with modern day Earth and just not fitting in while they're trying to fit in, and they're trying a little bit too hard, and they're coming up with inventive uses of cursing that aren't quite right. And, everything about this movie, it's just really perfect for watching with someone, just for no other reason than just to watch their reactions to these scenes and see how they like it. And, maybe they can appreciate something that I hadn't noticed before, or maybe they like something that I didn't really like and I can get a better appreciation for something that, I can think about something in a different light that I hadn't thought of before.
Sure, sure. Well, I remember a couple things. I did see this in the theaters. I guess I'm a little bit older than you, and I had seen all of the movies in the theaters, and this one was a real nice surprise. I have to be honest. Now you really enjoy time travel, obviously, with a name like Atos, and I've always been the guy that's like, yeah, I don't know if I like it. When I first heard about it and traveling back, I said, oh, it's going to be a little gimmicky. I was still excited to see it. It was the 20th anniversary. And there was a lot of stuff going on. So this is still before we had the Next Generation. It was a year before, I guess, the Next Generation came out. But we knew it had been announced. We had heard through reading Starlog and other things that Leonard Nimoy was part of this, and that Nicholas Meyer was back after his hiatus in Star Trek III, doing some of the writing. Nimoy was directing again, so that was pretty cool. There was a pretty cool bit that was done at a Star Trek convention I was at for the 20th, and it had a big to-do with Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner on an airplane talking about, hey, we've got this great idea for the 20th anniversary. We'll make another movie, and we'll call it Star Trek IV. And they were just going back and forth, having a good time, and it had everybody excited for it. But I do remember going to see it in the movie theater and being very pleasantly surprised at how much fun it was, how well done it was. It had some great lines, because you know they are considered such such heroes, and they are always, you know, saving the world, saving the universe, saving the galaxy, you name it. And here they were, just completely out of their element, trying to figure things out. Still, and you know, Kirk trying to be cool, and this was the movie or the episode where he doesn't get the girl. So there was a lot of humility in this movie, I thought. Mm-hmm. They were able to make fun of themselves, and they did a great job with it. And each member of the cast, I thought, had some really special moments. So, and speaking of those, I'm going to jump ahead to a point, then I'm going to go back to another one on the writing cast. So most of the cast got a special moment in the movie. You want to talk to some of those, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, we got everybody split up into teams, and each team went off to do something else. We have, some of the most famous bits with Chekhov and Uhura trying to find the nuclear vessels. Yeah, and perfect. Absolutely the worst person to send on a mission to find a nuclear, U.S. Navy nuclear vessel at during the Cold War is the Russian crew member, which was, right, you know, obviously half of the joke right there. And that also just further goes into just how out of their element all these characters were, because they had no clue that this was not really the appropriate choice. You've got the scene of Uhura and Chekhov trying to find the Alameda, and they can't find Alameda. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing that I've heard was that dialogue was recorded, just with random passersby, and those were like actual responses that they got from people who then, as soon as they walked away, were pulled aside and said, okay, we just filmed you for the Star Trek movie.
Yes, that's right. The woman who responded and said Alameda, yeah, and was giving them directions, they had to chase down and get a contract signed quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the police officer in that scene who was watching the whole thing, he was just set there as part of the detail. Right, because they had the streets blocked and closed, and you just watch him watching them like, this is ridiculous. That was pretty cool. What did you think? You know, what was nice was the McCoy Scotty dynamic. They played
too
off each other really, really well. It was nice to pull McCoy away from the dynamic with Spock and Kirk, and watch them just kind of have fun with each other. And I thought Scotty with the Mac computer and the mouse was perfect.
Yeah, just his complete discomfort with this ancient technology, and you know, trying to figure out how to use a computer that doesn't have a voice interface. They give him the mouse. He doesn't know what it is. They give him a keyboard, and he's like, how quaint.
Right.
And then he does things with the keyboard that are completely impossible to do with a keyboard.
Yeah, he was moving at a pretty quick pace, and I just like how he became the, I guess, the leader or the expert, and McCoy was kind of the assistant, right? You know, and
yeah.
Don't lose yourself into the part. That was pretty good. That was neat. And even Sulu had kind of a brief moment where he was talking mm-hmm. about the Huey helicopter with a pilot, I guess, at the same factory where they were looking at getting the plexiglass for the tanks. And there's a story that goes along with that too, Jeff. I think you're familiar with. They did attempt to make a more special scene for George Takei. Did you mm-hmm. want to discuss that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, there was. They were trying to have a scene where Sulu actually met his ancestor in San Francisco. Because he mentioned when they first approached, you know, San Francisco, I was born there. So that implies that his family has been there at least for some time. Mm-hmm. And so, like, they run into his ancestor, and he's a little boy, but they just couldn't get the little boy to act for the camera. And they ended up having to scrap the bit.
Yeah, it was too bad. I think he was meeting his great-grandfather or something. And
it was like great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, something like that.
Yeah, and that was a shame because they did make a valiant attempt, I think, at that point.
Yeah. And that would have been just a lovely scene to have if they could have filmed it.
Yeah. I felt bad reading that afterwards. I guess during the movie I didn't really think about it much. But, you know, back then when that was the only Star Trek, the rest of the cast and, you know, the ones below the line, as William Shatner used to say all the time, you know, we all love those guys, even though mm-hmm. they had very tiny parts or whatnot and didn't play a lot of critical roles. We love those guys, and we were kind of rooting for them to have more parts, because we'd been going to conventions at that point for a long time, and you could hear them kind of making their plea to the audience mm-hmm. for people to write in to support them. So they were always out there intermingling for the fans or with the fans, and we were always rooting for them to do well. And you know, in Star Trek II, obviously there was a big part for Chekhov, and there was supposed to be a big part in Star Trek II where Sulu gets command of the Excelsior, at least he's told he gets command of it, and that was cut, so George missed out on that. In Star Trek III, they gave Takei a nice scene breaking Bones out of the funny farm, and Uhura had a nice little scene herself, but really not much of one. And then in this movie, you know, you had the nice work with Chekhov and Uhura trying to get the high energy photons from the nuclear reactors. You had McCoy and you had Scotty doing their thing, and you had hilarious intertakes between Kirk and Spock. They really stole the show. And then there was poor George out there kind of in left field again. And, you know, the mm-hmm. the thing is that they did try, and you know, he gets his big plus up, I guess, in Star Trek VI. So when we talk about this movie, what was interesting, I think, Jeff, is, you know, you had Jack Sowards did the writing or put a lot of the plot points together for The Wrath of Khan. And then Nicholas Meyer rewrote that script, put it in a certain order, which they tweaked a little bit, him and Harve Bennett. But essentially, Nick Meyer took those concepts, rewrote the script. Star Trek III, 100% written by Harve Bennett, stem to stern. And then in Star Trek IV, it got a little bit more interesting. You want to talk about how these two writers came together?
Yeah, and this one, Harve Bennett and Nicholas Meyer, they came together and they split up the movie. You have Acts 1 and 4, which were basically the scenes set in the future, were written by Harve Bennett. And then Nicholas Meyer wrote Acts 2 and 3, which were basically the parts in the 80s. And it worked really well with the two of them splitting up their writing duties like that.
Yeah, the chemistry worked. You really couldn't tell a difference in the style, actually. It got a little bit funnier. But I think one of the interesting things is, too, is that Nicholas Meyer in 1980 put out a movie called Time After Time. Mm-hmm. And that also took place in San Francisco. And it was people from the past coming to the future with Malcolm McDonald, and who was the oh my goodness, so he played Gorkon, and he played St. John Talbot. I can't remember his name right now. It's escaping me. But at any rate, Star Trek, both of them wound up becoming parts of Star Trek and Generations, and like I just said, with those two movies. So I know I'll get it on the Babel Conference. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. It's awful. That's blasphemy. But at any rate, so Meyer had some prior dealings with San Francisco with a similar element. Like I said, only he flipped it. He made the they made them out of water because it was the future versus the past. And it really worked out well. So I think they found the perfect writing partner in making that happen. I want to say the guy's first name is David. No, I can't remember his last name. Isn't that awful? I hate that. I hate getting old, Jeff. Take your time getting here. Okay. So you're right. I thought the writing chemistry.
And you're right. His first name is David. I was just waiting to see if you could get it.
What is it? Come on. Don't torture me.
It's David Warner.
David Warner. Ah. You could have bailed me out a minute and a half ago there, buddy. You're supposed to be the Trexpert. Anyway, so David Warner, McDowell, excuse me, both made their thumbprint, put their thumbprints on Star Trek. Hopefully David Warner is known much more for Gorkon than he was for St. John Talbot in Star Trek V. So anyway, so yeah, the writing was crisp. It was funny. It was very well done. Now, one of the things too that they wrote in was some pretty cool new characters that I thought were very strong. What are your thoughts on Dr. Gillian Taylor and Catherine Hicks and the Klingon ambassador played by John Shuck?
Well, I'll start with the Klingon ambassador. I loved his character. And I loved him even more in Star Trek VI.
Did you?
He didn't get as much screen time, mm-hmm. but what he did get, he was just really good in those scenes.
Yeah, I agree.
He just chews up the scenery in all of the scenes that he's in both movies. And I loved seeing him back in VI. It was a nice touch for continuity as well.
Yeah. Now, do you know, was there any talk about bringing Shuck back for Star Trek V?
Not that I know of.
Okay. I guess I agree with you. He wasn't in it long, but when he was, he knocked it out of the park and had that great combination Klingon diplomat prosecutor type thing. And he definitely left his stamp, I thought, secure in Star Trek IV.
And he was really good on Enterprise.
He was. I do remember that episode. Yes, yes. Episodes. Excuse me.
Yeah, two-parter.
Two-parter, right.
Could be ancestor of the later ambassador.
Oh, did they tie that together? I didn't remember that piece.
No, they never actually said, but, I mean, you could easily make that argument.
Oh, okay. All right, so is that in Trekopedia as official, or...?
No, but, I mean, I don't see why it couldn't be. Who knows, maybe it's one of the novels, and I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah, it could be. I do like it when they bring back characters, and they did that a lot in Generations as well. You know, they pulled back the Klingon Chancellor the General from Star Trek V, and he became the Klingon Chancellor, and of course a lot of Robin Curtis, many people wound up in Generations in different roles, of course. And it was nice to see John Shuck in Enterprise. I thought that was more than appropriate.
Yeah, and Gillian Taylor was a really good character, too. I mean, really strong character, knew her stuff, and didn't take anything from anyone. And when Kirk was trying to make his moves, she wasn't really having any of it.
No, she wasn't.
which was a nice twist on the old trope.
Yeah, there was something about Catherine Hicks, and she was kind of a good mix, right? She was a professional, mm-hmm. a scientist, a doctor. She was very grounded, but also very, very emotional. Was very, very attached to the whales, and very believable. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She came off as very legitimate. And I thought too, like the way they kind of wrote her character with the old pickup truck. I don't know. There was something there. I also remember reading that when the whales were released and they didn't tell her, that when she slapped the curator of the Cetacean Institute, she slapped him good, and he was not prepared for it.
Yeah.
So she really got into that role as if somebody just took, you know, a loved one, a dear loved one away from you and just gave him a good whack. So pay close attention to that scene when you watch that. You know, you'll see his reaction is like, oh my God, we just I really took it. And, you know, a lot of those types of scenes too in Hollywood, you can kind of see the head moves with it and it's not really touching. But that time I'm not sure if they added the slapping sound effect or if they were able to catch the noise it made when she gave him a good whack. But the thing I like too is like you said, you know, Kirk doesn't get the girl. This is more of a relationship where they can help each other, where the whales can be saved from hunting, and she has the codes to get them there. She wants to be with them to watch them grow and you know, provide that science. And we also learn that one of the whales is pregnant because of Spock's mind meld. And I thought the way that she, insists on going and hugs Kirk just before they get beamed on board and helps, rescue the whales and do everything that needs to be done. But that end scene, that very end scene where Kirk is all suave and, you know, what does he say? You know, in your timeline, I don't even have your phone number. And she's just like, well, we'll catch you around the galaxy or something along those lines, or yeah. I'll call you, that type of thing. And the look on his face when she just walks away, I thought that was a real nice touch because, again, it brings a lot of humility to these characters. The whole movie did. And it looks like they had a great time making it.
Yeah. And there's a story in one of the Strange New Worlds anthologies. The title of it is perfect for her character. And she's one of the main characters in the story.
Okay.
And it's called The Hero of My Own Story.
All right.
And she absolutely is the hero of her own story in this film.
Yeah, she is.
Because really, they can't, the success of this mission cannot happen without her. They can't get the whales without her help.
No, that's true. I mean, she pulls it all together and like I said, they wrote it perfectly. They really did, I thought, on all fronts. And even the effects that they put together for this movie was really well done. The whales, the tail and all that stuff, okay. But the rest of it, you know, when they're out to sea and so forth, there's a couple of live shots that are put in there. But the animatronic whales, which I've seen at a convention or two, and their motion underwater, just beautiful. Looked very, very authentic. And to the point where I thought they had just filmed live whales in extraordinarily clear water. But that wasn't the case, so... Yeah, they did a nice job with those two. Okay. Another part, too, I wanted to talk about because I thought it was interesting. Now, a few weeks back, I had the pleasure of joining Brendan Shea Metalla on Melodic Treks, episode number 39, where he did an episode called There Be Whales Here, where we discussed, he and I, the music for Star Trek IV, which was also very different. What were your thoughts of this the theme that was put together by Leonard Rosenman?
I didn't know what to make of it at first, to be honest. It was nothing like that they had in any of the other Star Trek films. I mean, it was an orchestral piece, just like the others, but you know, the themes of the music, the tempo, just the feel of it, it felt different. And it wasn't what I was used to. It wasn't what I was comfortable with when I first heard it.
Really?
But it fits the movie perfectly.
Mm-hmm. So did you get the soundtrack for it?
I think I have that one. I have just about every Star Trek soundtrack, but I probably do have it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought the music was much more cheerful, almost chirpy would be a way to put it, I guess.
Yeah,
festive. I think that would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a good.
It was very festive, and it did have kind of if you know the opening sequence had a kind of I wouldn't say a rumpty tum, but it did have a beat like a science fiction movie, but then. It had, you know, more clarinets, more flutes, more things to lighten it up. So it had a theme. It definitely had a sci-fi theme in the beginning, and then the way he wrote it, like I said, it was a happy, festive soundtrack that was very, very different. And it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Score.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. that says a lot.
I mean, it's very well done. It's just not what I was expecting when I went to see the movie, and that's what kind of turned me off of it at first. But I did come to like it a lot later.
Yeah, and
because I realized that it's perfectly in tune with what the movie was, and that's exactly what a soundtrack needs to be.
No, that you're spot on, Jeff. He really did just knock it out, and in really in kind of doing the dive in, and I encourage people to listen to that episode. His history is really fascinating, and he and Leonard Nimoy, I guess, were pretty good friends, and that's how he got the gig. But like you, when the music started and it wasn't familiar, I was like, uh-oh. And when it was a name I didn't recognize, even back then, it's funny. You just go, oh boy, you know, is this going to work? And it did. It you know, there are tracks that have very solid beginning and ends with kind of great music in the middle. And you can listen to, you know, a 2 or 3 minute track, like The Escape from the Hospital was phenomenal. And it just, you know, had a great theme to it. And it was also the only Star Trek movie that I remember, too, where at the end, when they're running the credits, they're showing pictures and actual clips from the movie you just saw with the music going full bore. And it just kind of encapsulated that whole movie. Again, a very different approach from what we've seen before in other Star Trek movies.
Yeah, that is something that they hadn't really done before, or since, really.
No, not like that. But
yeah, I mean, the closest that they've come was the 2009 and Into Darkness, where they had kind of like the sci-fi space scene out flying through space. But even that, it's not, you know, what we're just watching in the film.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, all the different planetary shots and galactic shots and things. Yeah, yeah, you're right. With the actual Star Trek theme from the TV show blaring away. So yeah, that was pretty cool. All right, so those are the main points I wanted to hit, but I wanted to get onto some final thoughts. Now there were some firsts in this film, Jeff. Do you want to hit on some of those?
Yeah, one of them was we saw the first female Starfleet captain in this movie. She was played by Madge Sinclair, who was the captain of the Saratoga.
Right. Right. And do you remember her name, and, too? What the captain's name was?
They never gave a name for the captain, but the actress who played her was Madge Sinclair.
Yeah, I do remember that. And that was... It wasn't a big role, obviously, but it was a landmark, right? And a definitely a Star Trek first. And this was 1986, so you know it's funny growing up in that era. And I listen to a lot of the shows, and I read a lot of the Babel Conference when they talk about those timelines. You know, I know they quite legitimately have some interesting things to say about Star Trek in the 60s and its portrayal of women. But, you know, we've talked about how some of those shows were pretty iconic and forward-looking. And in 1986, it wasn't a crazy thing to think of a woman as a captain, which, you know, considering all the hoopla over Voyager, which was a big deal because it was a lead character, the star of the show being female, that was a big change. But, you know, in 1986, I had already been in the Navy 2 years. My very first commanding officer of the basic training that I went to was female captain. And I'll never forget her name because I thought it was ironic that I was going to boot camp and the CEO's name was Captain Nice. That just seemed to be a cruel joke Although she seemed very pleasant. I only saw her when we graduated. So. I don't know. But anyway, so that was pretty cool. And if I'm right about this, then the person that was Majel Barrett was back. She hadn't been back. She wasn't in 2 or 3, but she was in this movie, and you could see her in the command center. And I thought I had read that she was responsible or in charge of Starfleet Medical. And was I right on that, or was it some other part?
Well, it was pretty obvious that she was playing Chapel, and she was playing, you know, she had the medical uniform on. Yep. But I don't know if they were saying, you know, it was, I don't think it was ever actually said that she was in charge of Starfleet Medical, but clearly she was working at Starfleet Medical or at Starfleet headquarters in some sort of capacity, like maybe a liaison or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was trying to kind of flesh that out a little bit. Good thing to bring up in the Babel conference. I know there's people out there that know this stuff cold, because they're told every time I get something wrong or whatever and ask for clarification, I always get it. And it's not a one-up you type deal. For me, it's all clarification. And if somebody knows, let me know, you know, that type of thing. So, okay. What were kind of your final thoughts on Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home there, Jeff?
Well, one thing I thought was kind of odd was, they've got all this information about humpback whales and all this stuff on the Bird of Prey, mm-hmm. but they can't figure out this information on Earth.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a miss there.
You would think that Earth would have figured it out long before Kirk and crew did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. That was especially Spock, who's still trying to put things together, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it still works for the story. I mean, maybe they figured it out on Earth and just didn't tell anybody because they didn't think that there's anything can be done because the whales have been extinct for a couple of hundred years. Mm-hmm. And then Kirk is just like, well, we know how to time travel. Let's just do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you can always kind of pull those out of the movies, too. I mean, it does get me a little crazy from, and this was just me, especially when I was a younger kid, from the technical aspects of things. So in Star Trek, the motion picture, when they come out of dry dock, they're essentially just using thrusters, right? Getting a slow mm-hmm. amount of speed. And then when they go into impulse power, that ship is humming. I mean, it's moving. Mm-hmm. They're going at whatever they said, warp 0.5. And that thing was zooming through the solar system. And then, you know, you get to Star Trek III, and you know it's 1/4 impulse to exit the space dock, and the thing's barely creeping along, and it's slow. They have no consistency. And then in this mm-hmm. movie, they're in the atmosphere, and they're blasting into warp, right? And if you go into warp speed and you're only going to the sun, you're there in probably less than a half a second, I'm guessing, when you consider warp speed, right?
Warp 1 would be the speed of light. I mean, and we're 8.5 minutes away from the sun.
Right, and they were doing warp 7, warp 8, warp 9.
Yeah. I mean, they should have blown past the sun and been halfway to Vulcan.
Yeah, no, absolutely, that's what I meant. It's,
I mean, either that or they're just doing loops around like Superman.
Could have been, but it was those are things, like I said, those inconsistencies that I always kind of hey, listen, for anybody just watching the film, they don't care, it's just fun, the mm-hmm. ship's moving fast, I get it. But there was one thing that I thought was very, very interesting about this movie. Usually when they're going back in time, right, they're going back to fix something, mm-hmm. you know, to correct a wrong, because somebody screwed up the timeline. This was the first time, and I don't know if it's the only time, where they went back in time to change and alter the future. So on purpose. They were literally going there on purpose to bring back whales that were killed in the latter part of the 20th century. And they brought them to the 23rd century to restore, obviously, and get rid of that probe, and to fix things. But I don't remember anything ever happening, because essentially you would think that would be against all kinds of temporal laws and rules, in theory.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of get around that in the movie, at least with the whales, because they were about to get killed by the whalers. So one, it didn't really matter about the whales, because either way, they were going to die or disappear from the timeline, which is basically the same effect on history. But Jillian disappearing from history is a totally other question, because, I mean, what was she going to do afterward in the timeline that she now can no longer do because she's not in history?
Well, there's that piece where, you know, obviously she's the only person that's an expert on whales in the 23rd century, because there aren't any, or there aren't any humpback whales as far as we know.
Yeah, my point is that, you know, in the original timeline, yeah. You know, before she got removed from history, because, you know, she's 1986 happens, and then in the, you know, originally she continues to live on after the whales have been taken away. You know, all the things that she would have done in the timeline beyond the point where Kirk and crew went back to now can no longer happen with her. So, you know, it's got to have some kind of an impact on history.
Well, you're right about that. You're absolutely right. But
and that's, you know, something else, you know, they bring up with the time travel episodes, like with the, you know, Deep Space Nine, where they're complaining about Kirk with the 14 separate violations of the Temporal Prime Directive. This would be one of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I guess the interesting piece to me is they went back in time to fix a wrong, but they're rescuing Earth. But Earth did it to themselves, right? The people of Earth were mm-hmm. short-sighted. They killed the whales. This thing comes looking for the whales, and it just devastates the Earth. So here's my theoretical question, Mr. Atos. So the Enterprise crew, they've got their, either whether they're on the old Enterprise or the A, it doesn't matter. They fly to a planet that's being decimated by a probe. The people on the planet signal the Enterprise that the only way that they can save them is to go back in time into their own history, fix a wrong that was done, and bring them into the future. Would they do it?
I don't know. I don't think they would.
That's what I'm saying. There's a double standard, I think, when it comes mm-hmm. to yeah. Earth. And that's where I was going. That's the interesting yeah. premise of this show to me, is that, mm-hmm. you know, for all the right reasons, I think we could sit back and make a good justification for doing it. But should they have? That's another question. And, you know, obviously, they changed history.
Yeah, they changed, and Kirk is breaking from that all point, of Earth the rules done. In these movies. Yeah, Kirk is breaking all the rules in these movies. You know, stealing the Enterprise, going back in time.
Yep, he is. And, you know, it was an interesting direction to take the cast and to take Kirk and to do these things with. Like I said, for all the right reasons, they created some mm-hmm. brilliant storylines. And I know that's, you know, we kind of got used to the renegade Captain Kirk, which is why I kind of struggled a little bit with 2009, because he pretty much throughout the original series, other than A Mock Time, and that was righted too, he really did follow the rules. You know, he mm-hmm. he did what he was supposed to do. He was not rogue by any means, but he had a little bit more, I guess, freedom to make decisions, especially when you're out on a 5-year mission far, far away. It might have been a little bit more aggressive, but anyway, that to me was that historical piece of it, of going back to correct a wrong on Earth, where I don't think by their own philosophical and prime directive rules and regulations would have ever done it for another planet.
Yeah, and this could also be the reason why we have a temporal prime directive in later Star Trek.
It could be. It could be. It would be interesting to kind of tie those together. Maybe that's another line you can draw on your website there to see if that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. what's to stop any planet from doing just that, to change history mm-hmm. for any reason, where you really don't want to, right? That would be my thought process there. Okay. Anything else on the show, Jeff? Anything else on the movie? I'm sorry.
I think we've covered just about everything that I can think of at this point.
I think so, too.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we've really talked about the time travel a lot, especially since, you know, like we were saying, every other time we've seen the time travel, they've either been correcting someone else going back and changing history, or just going back and observing history. this is the only time we've actually seen them actively going back to change something themselves.
That's right. That's right. That's what makes it unique. Okay. All right. Well, with that, so it's been a great time discussing Star Trek IV, the Voyage Home, here on Standard Orbit. But this isn't the only topic we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
50 years, there's been something to carry it this far. In that vein of, hey, it's our generation or our era's mythic heroes that we can look up to. Do we dare put that in something that's lasted as long as, you know, literary-wise, Shakespeare and some of the other myths of you know, the ancients that have found a purpose and a use that still speak to people?
The Orb.
The wonderful thing about Z'all is she just has it in spades. You know, I mean, she's been mistreated her entire life by her parents and yet has turned out to be this beautiful, amazing person. Part of that's probably Kira taking care of her for so long now.
Yeah.
Women at Warp.
Admiral Alan Alda came to visit Captain Coretta Scott King. Meanwhile, morale officer Beyonce is trying to deal with her new Weasley sweater, and
they're all partying at the First Contact party.
Melodic Trex. This score is one of my favorites for Star Trek The Next Generation and is similar in many ways to a film score that I love. The episode is Data Lore, and the film score that I will compare this to is Alien by Jerry Goldsmith. And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So, Jeff, Mr. Atos, please let all our listeners know how they can access all avenues to Trek FM.
Well, you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm, and you can grab the RSS link there as well. And if you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes, and it helps us to increase our visibility for new listeners.
Thank you, Jeff. And then, you know, another big piece of what makes this show so successful is that we're allowed to bring you uninterrupted podcasting. No ads, no commercials. Due to the use of Patreon and to our patrons who donate money to this network. So what is Patreon? So Patreon is the system that Trek FM employs for listeners to donate money to keep this show running, to help us buy equipment, in order to bring really good podcast shows to you. And I'll tell you, they reinvest that money, folks. They have so many shows on the network. I saw a new one just launched. Mm-hmm. So I think it's up to almost 21 different shows on this
network.
And we're
trying to bring back some of the old ones that aren't showing right now, too.
Yeah, it's amazing what they're doing. So in appreciation for your donations, we do have certain perks for certain levels. So if you can donate $15 a month, then you get a seat on the Patrons Roundtable. And what's really neat about that is that you can get your shot at podcasting, talking to a bunch of the hosts, and really seeing how it's done. And it's such a great format. It's where I met Jeff. It's where I met Norm on the first roundtable back in, you know what? It was last June. It was a year ago this month. As mm-hmm. I remember being in a hotel room in San Diego and getting online with just my headphones using Zoom, and there we were. So yeah, a year ago. So that's impressive. And for $25 a month, you can have associate producer credit for whatever show you like. And you know, the only thing we ask is if you can contribute, to contribute. And the other piece of it that's really cool is that you're not locked in. So if one month you can afford a little bit more than another, that's fine. If you run into some rough times and need to pull it back, you can pull it back. It's very, very flexible. And any contribution that you can make means so much. And I have to say that Jeff, Norm, and I, we're all very large contributors to Patreon. We do practice what we preach. So please log on to patreon.com. That's spelled patreon.com/trekfm. Any contribution you can make is greatly appreciated. So along those lines, we want to thank always the associate producers for Standard Orbit, Renee Roberts and Richard Rutledge. believe these guys and ladies, they've been here since the beginning. We want to thank you so much for all your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM. I mean, we just love what you do for us. It's incredible. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701 and Richard at RUT8972, both on Twitter. So thanks again. And one other thing too that you can help, one thing that you can do to help us support Trek FM is if you want to wear any of the Trek.fm fandom, you can find great Trek FM theme merchandise at Redbubble. Just type in Trek FM into the search field, and there's all kinds of great shirts and designs that Aaron Harvey has put together for us. I've got a couple now, and I'm looking to increase my wardrobe there, and that'll definitely be a big piece. And also, if you're able to stump Mr. Ataz, I will buy you the Trek FM shirt of your choice from redbubble.com, so please keep your questions coming. To contact us, if you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and you can leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and the best way to communicate with me and the rest of us is through the Babel Conference. So the Babel Conference, spelled B-A-B-E-L, into the search field into Facebook. And it is a closed group, but you just put a request in there. The admins will let you in. And we have some great conversation in there. Everybody is on their best behavior. It is not your typical Facebook page, folks. Trust me. That's where you can go in and IM me and send questions in that I can used to try to stump Mr. Ataz. And if you're successful, like I said, I'll buy you a shirt from Redbubble. So that's how it works for me. Jeff, what is your contact information?
Well, if you don't have access to an Atavacron or even a stolen bird of prey that you can loop around the sun, you can always find me on the Babel Conference on Facebook. I'm the co-host on the network for both Standard Orbit and for Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated enterprise show. I'm also on Twitter at Harlander, and I'm a supporter of the network through Patreon. You can check out my website. It's been called The Grand Unified Theory of Star Trek at Trekopedia.com, and my independent comic books at BandwidthComics.com, or search on Facebook for Bandwidth Comics.
Yeah, so just to follow up with Norm's information, if you'd like to get in touch with Norm, you can always find him here on the network or on the Babel Conference. You can find Norm on Twitter at Starfighter1701.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.